Welcome back to Minds Matter, a podcast sponsored by the Monash Center for Consciousness and Contemplative Studies. I'm Ava.
And I'm Beth. And on Minds Matter, we explore research from psychology to neuroscience while occasionally talking through our own personal experiences.
This week on the podcast, we have a very special guest. Our guest is currently a PhD student at Monash in philosophy and psychology. We love an interdisciplinary girl, and she has been doing a lot of research on optimism and what optimism means and how we can infuse our lives with more of that, and doing some really cool interdisciplinary studies looking at optimism in animal models, but also doing simulation studies. And hopefully we'll talk about also some prospective studies that might be done on humans soon. And our guest, if you didn't know, is our soon-to-be Dr. Beth Fisher, Elizabeth L. Fisher, if you're a Google Scholar. L? No, isn't it?
Elf. No, it's right. So that whenever my papers, Elf collected the data. Elf,
our little elf. Our very own little elf is here today. So do you want to introduce yourself, Beth? I mean, we might have some first-time listeners who don't know what you do, and certainly you don't know what you do as a researcher and not as a podcast maven.
Thank you for that very cute introduction, Ava, and I'm super excited to be interviewed. So I'm doing my PhD at Monash with Jakob Hovey and Claire Foldy, and before that, I guess it's how I got to where I am. I think I like to tell that story because I think it's nice to know that not everything's just like one straight path of, oh, you just wake up, know what you're going to do and go and do it. Mine hasn't been like that at all. So I started my undergrad at Melbourne Uni, and then I got a 3-week scholarship to go to NYU, and I went and I was like, I just need to stay here. So I just stayed and I studied biology, and I have minors in philosophy and German, which, I mean, I don't really know why I did that at all on reflection. But I was in pre-med and I was going to be a doctor, and I had a professor be like, oh, maybe you should work in hospitals, like in research environments first, because he was a bit worried about how sensitive I was. And he was right, because then I worked in research in New York. So there you have labs that are in hospitals, and being in there, just being around seeing patients, just walk through. I got too sad. So I was like, all right, well, I can't be a doctor. So I did research on gene therapy, and then I did research in preclinical PET imaging. And I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I wanted to be a doctor, but that's not right. Will I do a PhD? And I was like, I'm done with research. I'm going to get a master's that will give me coding skills so I can go into tech. And like lots of my life decisions, I decided to do that in Amsterdam because of a man. So I did my master's in brain and cognitive science in Amsterdam. That's where I met Ava. So I'm so thankful for that. And then when I was doing that master's, COVID happened. So I had to go back home to Australia. And I had done a research project on quantum color cognition. So how we can understand how we perceive color through quantum models. And quantum models, it's not as complicated as it sounds. But I was doing that, and then I started a PhD in that. And that's what my PhD started off in. And then I had this chat with my supervisor, and he was, what do you want to leave in the world? What do you want to do in the world? And I really only started the PhD because I was interested in this color quantum cognition. It was cool. And yeah, I was like, we're just going to be at home, so I might as well research this for 3 years. And then Jakob had this really beautiful conversation with me about, how I see the world and what I want to do. And when I thought about that a lot, I was like, I really want to help people. And color quantum cognition might not reach that goal. And I did all this reading and I was like, I want to study optimism. And Jakob's amazing and he supported me completely changing. And now I'm like the optimism girly. But I just wanted to share all that. It's been a very recent thing. It hasn't been something that I always knew that I wanted to do. I had no computational modeling skills or anything like that. But I just had this feeling that this is a topic that, I don't know, I just saw something in it that I thought it could really help people. And then I've just been very fortunate that my work, I've been lucky to get good results and it's going well. But yeah, it wasn't a chosen path from early on at all.
I didn't know that's what happened, actually.
Oh, really?
I remember that you were doing the color stuff, and then you weren't.
I didn't even realize what had happened.
And, okay, we can talk a little bit more about what optimism is in a second, but... Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about a couple of papers because she's publishing, ladies and gents. But one of the papers that we're going to talk about is like this study that you have where you use a RAP model to look at optimism. So just how did that come about? Also for our background knowledge, because was it that you were like, oh, I'm interested in optimism and someone happened to be studying something? Or you were like, I think that there's something that I can do with data that is out there.
Yeah, so my secondary supervisor, Claire Foldy, she does a lot of amazing rat research with psychedelics. And so we were talking about ideas for things and she showed me this data set. And I was like, oh, from what I can see from this behavior is it looks like the rats are more optimistic. So it wasn't this, again, it was none of this was all set up or anything. I was like, oh, this... I can see that I think that this is optimism. And then I ran some simulations. Oh, this looks promising. And then worked to fit the data. So I think the lesson behind that is there's so much data out there already that if you can, use that. So that, I mean, there's just, especially with animal work, there's so much stuff. And now so much of it is, well, it should all be like open access. Or people might have data they did one analysis on and you can do another one. And yeah, I would really recommend if you're thinking about collecting data, maybe have a think about what's already there, especially in the animal research world when there's so much cool stuff already being collected.
Yeah, I think that's good advice because I think people feel that they need to collect their own data, but it really is like one of the most time-consuming steps of research. And most data sets, there's so much potential that we're not using it for. So before we get into everything, you said you were like drawn to setting optimism. So what is optimism to you and what does it mean in your research? And why do you think you were drawn to it? I have my own hypothesis about the last question.
So optimism is bias that people have where they overestimate the likelihood of good things. And they underestimate the likelihood of bad things. And this plays out in different ways. It means you learn more from good events and less from bad events. And it means because you think good things will happen, you're more likely to do things. Because the chance of divorce from marriage is like 50%. So it's the same as a coin flip. But no one really believes that's our optimism. We're like, no, that doesn't feel right. So then we go off and we get married and we go off and we do things like that. Because we believe we'll have a good outcome. And this is really adaptive because by going out in the world and engaging in things, not everything will work out for us, but some things will. And the opposite of that, if we weren't to engage in the world because we thought good things will happen, we would just withdraw and we would stay at home and not engage and have all these benefits from being out in the world and minimizing our risk of missed opportunity. And what's really interesting about optimism is it's seen across nearly all species. So bees have optimism, horses have optimism, like there's so many cool animal work in optimism. So it obviously is this really adaptive bias that we have. And what I think is really interesting about biases, and I think Ava might remember some of my work in the masters was on causal reasoning and how we have errors in causal reasoning. And I always thought, it's interesting when we say things are errors because obviously we can causal reason in a way that's good enough because we're all living here now, surviving. So something about these things that we say are wrong or errors, but there's something to them because otherwise we wouldn't be where we are right now. And I thought with optimism, it's the same thing. Well, it's so interesting the fact that not seeing the world as it is a good thing. But that's so fascinating because you really would think that to make the best decisions in life, you should just represent the information as it actually is in the world and make decisions from there. That's what really drew me to optimism. How is it that it's really good not to see the world as it is? And how that is so adaptive? And what happens when this goes wrong, when we don't have this? And personally, I guess if you guys have listened to the podcast or you know me, I'm an optimist. Probably even from my background story, it's changing all these things, going off and doing it, moving countries for love. Like, they're all very optimistic actions. But again, if I didn't do all those things, like, I wouldn't have met Ava. I wouldn't have. So although lots of the things that I didn't work out, I got all those benefits from being out and taking these chances and being involved in the world. So I think that's what drew me to optimism. And I think the other thing is, and Ava again would know this, it's not that I don't get sad, and it's not that I don't get depressed, and it's not like I'm delusional and yay, I'm just, everything's wonderful. It's not the case at all. Like, I just know how those feelings are, and why optimism is a good choice because of that, if that makes sense. So it's not like I'm totally delusional, which sometimes I do wonder if people think.
I mean, I feel like your research, if someone on TikTok were to want to summarize it, there's a very like popular trend that is like Delulu is the Salulu. And it is a bit like that, like not completely delusional, which I mean, we'll talk about like optimal levels of optimism, which you'll explore in some simulation work. But I think that you have to kid yourself a bit. Yeah. The world is kind of terrible.
I think that's one of the things when I'm trying to do examples of the good outcomes to show optimism. I don't know, if you go for runs or something, the chance of increasing your risk of heart disease is actually really low. Like, it's not very high at all. And then I started looking at all these health outcomes. I'm like, oh, this actually isn't very good. But we need to think, oh, it's going to make my heart 50% better, so then I go on the run, or you just wouldn't do it. Yeah, looking at the real world statistics unfortunately, it's not that great. But good news is we have optimism.
So I feel like a lot of the times when we think about biases, they sound really cognitive. But it sounds like optimism in this definition is really behavioral in a way, right? Because do you think that animals like horses or bees or rats, like we'll talk about, that they have optimism in the sense of being like, yeah, I think things will go well, or they're just going and doing it? What's the distinction between the cognitive and the behavioral, if you think there is one?
So one of the ways that bias plays out is how we update information. Even though that's cognitive, we're not thinking, it's like we're not aware of that, because that's just how, I guess that's the whole issue with a bias, it's just how we see the world. So I guess how we see the world, that is a cognitive thing, I would say. I don't know if you would say that too. But then that leads to the behavior. So that for the animals, yeah, they don't think. Well, I don't know. We don't know what animals are thinking. But the way we measure it in animals, it's not, oh, how are you feeling today? Are things going to be going well for you? One of the ways we measure it in animals is this ambiguous cue task, where a high tone corresponds to a reward and a low tone corresponds to a negative thing. And then you see, what does an animal do when they hear a tone in the middle? So this tone doesn't correspond to anything. And if animals are optimistic, they hear that tone and they act as if they're getting a reward. Mm-hmm. So this ambiguous cue, they're like, oh, that's a good thing. And if they're pessimistic, so models of depression or haven't been in a good environment, they respond to that middle tone as if they're getting the negative outcome. So although that would be a cognitive process of how they're interpreting the tone, I don't think the animal is like thinking, oh, the world's good or bad. It's just like how they're processing that information, if that makes sense.
Yeah, what they're doing with it, even if it's not like they're thinking about it on a meta level.
But it's a good question, because I think there are ways that you can talk about optimism on this meta level in humans. So I think it's good to understand how those two things work.
Okay, let's get into your paper. So we previewed some of this work, but you have a study that looks specifically at the influence of psilocybin administration in rats and how that influences optimism. Is there a reason that you were interested in psilocybin, or was it just, as you mentioned, this is the data that was there? And I was like, ooh, looks like optimism.
Well, it was part of the data was there, but also because psilocybin is getting a lot of hype at the moment for treatments of depression. And it doesn't just have to be interventions that are getting a lot of hype, but I was interested in how different interventions that we have, how they might relate to optimism. So there is a few studies showing that psilocybin increases people's more feelings of optimism. So not the way we measured it 6 months after the dose and things. So there was that link there.
And what did you do? How did you do this in rats? Tell us all the nitty-gritty details. Nitty-gritty. Of getting rats to trip and
what we did was the rats were given a dose of psilocybin, and they're given a dose that is the same that would be a therapeutic dose if you were go to get this in a clinical setting. And on that day that the rats are given enough, like they would be high, they would get that sense of the trip as we would think about it.
Wait, can I ask you a question? Is this like a dose down for a rat, I'm assuming, right? Not as much as a human would get in clinical? Or is
it's measured by weight. Okay. So it's the same percentage of weight for the rat as it is for the human, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. I just was like, damn, they're charged full.
And there's ways you can measure to make sure the rat is like having the high and having the experiences like head twitches and their behavior and things. So they're given this dose, they have this trip, and then we start measuring the behavior 24 hours after the dose. So none of our behavioral measures are when the rat is high. We're looking at the post-acute effects. So this is, after you're given the psilocybin, what happens afterwards? And this is a really important question, because if we're going to use these things in clinical settings, it's like, okay, well, after the patient comes into the clinic and we give them the dose, what's going to happen to their life after, which is what we're trying to change. This is like really important to see. So the rats are given the dose, and then 24 hours after the dose, we start measuring their behavior through this task. And what the task was, it was a reversal learning task where the rat could poke on the left side or the right side of this little device. And 10 times they would poke on the left, and each time they would get a sugar pellet as a reward. And then 10 correct pokes on the left would reverse the device to then make the right side rewarded. So what the rat had to learn to do was to poke 10 times on the left and then 10 times on the right and go back and forth. But what was really cool about this task is the device was in the home cage of the rat. So the rat could decide to either engage with the task by poking left or right, or just sit in the cage and do nothing. And if we're thinking about the things that I've spoken about optimism so far, this is a very important element of optimism. Is the individual or the rat or the animal going to go and engage in the task and go out in the world, or are they just going to withdraw and stay in their cage and not do anything? And the reason why the rat might decide to just stay and withdraw rather than engaging in the task is that if you withdraw and for the rat in this setting, they're safe. So they have nothing to lose. Whereas if you engage in the task, you can go and engage in the task and get a loss. So the loss is selecting the port and not getting a sugar pellet. So that it's not like a shock or anything, but the idea is it's exerting energy. So it's not a rewarding experience for the rat.
So every 10 times, they get a reward, and it's not a variable reward schedule. It's just each 10 times.
Yeah. Okay. And then if they've selected the left 7 times and they get a reward each time, and then they select the right, they wouldn't get the reward because it hasn't switched yet.
So is it like, so if they select left 7 times and then the right again, do they still need to hit the left 3 more times to get the reward?
Exactly. And we did this for 3 hours a day for 14 days. So this same task they did. And so the 2 weeks in the rat, this is like quite a bit of their lifespan. So that's not an exact translation to humans, but we can think about this is months after, if we were in humans, how the psilocybin would be affecting a human if we're looking at how to translate that. So for the behavioral measures of that task, we can see how many rewards the rat got. We can see how many losses they got. And we can see how many times they decided just to stay in the cage rather than engage in the task. And what was really cool about the behavior is that the rats that were treated with psilocybin, so we also have a control group that were given just saline. So that's just an injection of like salt water, and it doesn't do anything for the rat. One of the really good things about using animal studies for psychedelic research is that you can have a good control. Of course, one of the issues, everyone's probably seen that New Yorker cartoon. So I feel like it's very famous. Oh, I obviously got the control because all the people who were given the psychedelics dancing around the room. But that's a really big problem. So with rats, it's great because they don't have that awareness of, so you can get a proper control. And so what we found was, is that the rats that were treated with psilocybin, they are getting more rewards over time. So they're getting more rewards. And when we looked at the behavior, it wasn't because they were learning the task better. It's because they were just deciding to do the task more. So they're deciding to engage in the task more. So this looks like optimism because they're deciding, all right, I'm going to go off. I'm going to go and give this task a go because there's this chance of getting a reward. And the saline rats are more like, no, I just want to stay in my cage and engage less. So I'll get less rewards overall, but I'll be safer.
So basically we have these rats that were tripping. And yeah. Now after that experience, we at least see that they're engaging more with whatever task that could potentially lead them to have a reward. What do you think is going on? Like, why do you think that it's having that effect?
I guess what I'll do now is talk about the modeling because, you know, you can look at this behavior and you could say, well, this could be a range of things. Like, how do you know that's optimism? So what we wanted to do was look at the mechanisms of the decision-making on the rat. How is the psilocybin affecting that? So we use computational modeling methods where basically we get these equations that represent how the rat's making a decision. And we can look at different elements of that equation to see, okay, well, what things are affecting their decision-making. And what we found was, is that the rats treated with psilocybin had an asymmetry in belief updating. So what this means is the belief updating is how much they update their model when they get new information. And we found that the rats treated with psilocybin had learnt more from the reward and less from the loss. So they updated more to a good thing and less than a bad thing. And this was super exciting because this is how we measure optimism in humans. So that asymmetry in belief updating and showing how the psilocybin affected that mechanism was like, okay, well, this is optimism. Another thing we found was the psilocybin reduced the loss aversion in the rats. So loss aversion is just say I go out into the world and I have, so just say I go to a party and I have a bad time. How much does that affect me? Do I go to a party, have a bad time, and I'm like, oh, it doesn't really matter, I'll go again. That would mean I have low loss aversion because the loss is it doesn't really affect me. If I go to a party, I have a really bad time and it affects me a lot, I would have high loss aversion because I really don't want to have that experience again. And we found that the psilocybin reduced loss aversion, so it meant that the rat was more okay when they came up to a face of a loss. And this, again, is really exciting because this is something that people with depression who lack optimism have. If they go out into the world and something bad happens, it really affects them. So we found that the psilocybin worked on the two different mechanisms of changing the belief updating and reduce the loss aversion. And these findings are consistent with how we would consider optimism.
I feel like computational modeling, when you don't know what's really going on, it's like magical because you're just like, we have these equations and then we just have their behavior, but we're able to get all these latent variables just from the numbers. It's amazing. I think it's just a really cool technique for people who are interested in newer methods.
Love computational modeling, and all the code and everything is all online. So if anyone's interested, they can go and look at the models and have a go.
Yeah, that's great. And I feel like it's really cool to know the mechanism and that it's working on kind of both of these fronts that are important.
Yeah, exactly.
So do you have a hypothesis on what it is that's happening in the brain, I guess, when they're on the drug that then, I don't know if it's creating some kind of rewiring, if it's specifically influencing circuits that are important for learning?
So I'm not a neurobiology expert at all, but I've spoken to some experts and one of the theories is, so when people are given psilocybin, it increases their serotonin. And there's this theory that we actually spoke about when we had our neurobiology episode that increased serotonin increases plasticity in the brain, which allows people or rats to start looking at new ways they can engage in the world. So we have a set of actions that we do every day and we get used to those actions. And the idea is, well, when do I decide I want to try something new? When do I decide I'm going to go to the new coffee shop rather than my classic one? When do I decide I'm going to go to a new restaurant? So that's called exploration. Because exploitation is doing what I do every day. And then exploration is going and doing these new things. And so the theory is that, well, if the serotonin increases, that increases exploration in the human or the rat. So I can go out and try new actions. So I'm going to try that new coffee shop. I'm going to go to the new restaurant. And then in this environment, because increasing exploration is a good thing, because the reward structure is they're doing the task, they get a reward. And also the loss that they have isn't detrimental to their survival. Like they just miss out on a sugar pellet. So by increasing serotonin and exploration, the rat is more open to these new policies. Actions, that's another word for policies. And then over time, they learn that's a good thing. So then it becomes part of their strategy. So the serotonin allows this increased exploration, which sets up the rat to be able to explore more and learn in this optimistic way. So that's one theory that we have.
Okay, speculative question.
Yeah.
If there were to have been a shock or something involved, or if it were not only are you sometimes getting a sugar pellet, but you're sometimes getting a shock. So there's, if there were like a neutral where they're getting nothing, shock and positive sugar pill, do you think that would have changed things? And can you speculate as to whether, even if something really bad happens, does this optimism, do you think it could persist?
So that is such a good question and a really good question if we're going to think about clinical interventions. Because if psilocybin is increasing this exploration, we need to make sure that the environment the patient is in is one that affords these positive outcomes. So we need to make sure the patient is somewhere where, okay, they're going to, we want them out of this depressive slump where they're just staying at home and we want them to go out into the world. But is their world going to give them rewards? Is their world going to give them sugar pellets? And lots of people who are in situations where they have depression are not in an environment that will give them rewards. So it's going to be really important, exactly as you said, to look at how this kind of study plays out when the environment of the rat's a little different. So if it was a shock and they keep engaging, like that's not going to be a good thing. And all these questions are really important. And that's what's so nice about the computational modeling is that we can model the environment, we can model the rat or the human and see, okay, well, in what scenarios is this adaptive and what scenarios is this maladaptive and who is this good for and who is this not good for? Another thing I think is important to think about as well is, so we're saying optimism is a really good thing, but we need to think about the environment that someone is in. Even if we're optimistic, it's not something that's just, you know, we're dynamic creatures, our environments are dynamic. We change things in different scenarios. So you can be really optimistic, but you can also then be in a car accident and know that you're going to have to learn from that negative thing in that moment. So this optimism doesn't control everything and stay at the same level all the time. So it's also questions around that as well. And I think that's the same with lots of elements of how we make decisions. We're not always applying the same models and strategies in every environment we're in. I mean, that we wouldn't survive if we did that.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask too, because you've talked about before how in certain situations, optimism isn't great, not just if it's you're in an environment where you're subject to actually experiencing shocks or like experiencing some kind of painful experience, but in situations like, yeah, climate change, if we're like, I think it's going to be fine. And I know that people in that realm also discuss differences between optimism and hope, where one is more just blindly thinking everything's going to be okay. And the other is like, I think it could be okay, but we have to put effort in. But it sounds like what's really important if you look at these varying levels of optimism, because as you said, maybe it's good to have it be flexible. And is it really that we want there to be a baseline that is relatively high and then that we're able to like flexibly deploy that optimism at different points? Is that something that you can model as well?
Yeah. And I think that flexibility in changing, so I haven't modeled that specifically, but I think that's going to be really important. So you have an agent, that's just the word we say for a model in one environment, and how can they change their level of optimism in different environments that can change how our brain is seeing what context we're in. So there's this idea of changing optimism levels for different environments. And it would make sense that that's the way it works because, yeah, if you're in a traumatic event in that moment, you're not learning from the small good. It doesn't work that way. And then it's good that it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I feel like that would be cool to see in different situations whether this, I mean, even this intervention, whether that leads people or the rats, not the people, to act differently in the environment or subject to a bunch of shocks. So you talked about ways to simulate this type of data. So we've been talking about how this is done with rats, but obviously, ultimately, I mean, we're very happy to make the rats more optimistic, but ultimately, I think your main interest is clinical interventions. So could you tell us a little bit about how this works and maybe the limits of, which you've touched on a bit, but the limits of actually intervening clinically and how simulations can get around some of these issues before we're ready to go in to actually test things on humans?
Yeah, so with the rat work, the idea is to translate that to humans, but obviously we can't, there's so many things that we can't get the same amount of data from humans because we can't monitor them the same way we can with the rats and all this kind of stuff. But it's really important that we have an understanding to the same level as we do in the rats for humans when we're going to any kind of intervention. And we don't have that with a lot of things that we use. And I think I've spoken about this before, but I really love the field of computational psychiatry, where the idea is that we can understand these mechanisms for individuals and know how different interventions work for them or where are their symptoms coming from. And I think I've said this before, but, you know, one of the issues is at the moment you're depressed, you go to the doctor, you fill out a self-report, and then you just have to try each antidepressant until hopefully one of them works. And I think a third of people they don't work for, a third of people they will work for, but they'll take a few times, and a third of people they work right away. So I think we should be able to know what third you fall in before you go through all of that pain. And so that's the idea of these models, is that we can have that understanding. And one of the things that's great about modeling is you can run simulations. So a simulation is just writing up how you think these mechanisms are playing out in the brain. So how someone's making the decisions they are, and just running them on the computer, and you can see a simulated behavior. And by doing this and testing this, we can think about what we're interested in and our hypotheses, and simulate it before you actually go out and get humans involved. So it's just like this nice check. So if I think, oh, optimism is this, then I can simulate and do all these checks to make sure that the dynamics of and the mechanisms of the model are playing out the way I want them to or expect them to before I go out and get people to do a whole bunch of tasks or people, yeah. And so it saves a lot of time, it saves a lot of resources. And it also, if it's going to a clinical setting, can save people a lot of pain as well, if we already have some idea of how these things are playing out. So my other work is a simulation paper where I've done this. I've set up a theoretical model of the mechanisms of optimism, and I've run it through different tasks to see if I can replicate what's seen in the literature. And then if you can do that, you have some evidence that your model is hopefully worthwhile. And then the next step is, okay, well, now I can go and collect data and see how we can actually use this in a clinical setting.
And so from your simulation paper, do you find that there is a ceiling effect to how good optimism can be? Are there things that optimism is particularly helpful with? So what was the task and that you had your simulations do?
So we did a few things. The first thing we did was run the simulations over childhood. So this is like development of the agent. And the reason behind that is it's been shown that individuals who grow up in difficult environments have lower optimism. And this can be from different things like not having a stable environment to how the parents treated the child, these different things, and then they're shown to have lower optimism. Another thing with optimism is optimists have so many good things. I don't know if I've listed them all off, but they have better cognitive function after traumatic brain injury, better heart health, better immune response to stresses. They earn more money. It's just good for so many things. And one of them is better heart health and better arousal response to stress. So there's been studies to show if you're more optimistic, you're better at maintaining how you respond to a stressful environment. In this first step of the simulation, what we wanted to do was to see, can we simulate how optimism is lost in development if you're exposed to these negative events? And on top of that, can we simulate the mechanisms of how arousal plays into that? So can we show if you're exposed to a lot of negative events in childhood, you lose optimism and then you also are not as good at maintaining arousal. And if you're not as good at maintaining arousal, that can lead to like panic, anxiety, all these things. You know, you get the heartbeat racing all the time. You can feel sweaty, that kind of stuff. In this simulation, we found exactly that. So we found that agents who were exposed to more negative things lost optimism over time. And then they had higher arousal outcomes. So they were just more anxious more often. That's what the first study showed. And then we wanted to take these agents and put them through tasks that are shown in the literature to see, okay, well, does this optimism that we're talking about, can it replicate different tasks? Because then our model is grounded in some sort of literature that's already out there in empirical work. And so there's this belief updating task that is used to measure optimism. And so you're given the likelihood of a bad thing happening to you, getting cancer, getting robbed, something like that. And you're asked to estimate, well, how likely do you think that is to happen to you? And then you're told how likely it really is. And you either get good news or bad news. So if I say, oh, my risk of cancer is 10%, but I'm told it's 50%, then that's bad news. If I was told it's 5%, that's good news. And then you're asked to estimate your likelihood again. And you measure how much you update your information to good news versus bad news. And optimistic people, which we've already touched on, they update information more to good news than bad news. So they have this asymmetry in how they update their beliefs. And it's been shown that people with depression update the same to good and bad news. So we wanted to see if we can replicate that finding with our different levels of optimism through our different agents. And we did. So we found that the more optimistic our agents were, the more they updated to good news. And the less optimistic they were, the more they updated to bad news. So this was exciting because this shows, okay, well, our model can replicate this finding. And this is just, in this task, because it's just the updating to good or bad news, we're not actually able to see the adaptiveness of the optimism because it's just this belief updating. There's no real rewards or losses. Then we wanted to say, okay, well, how does this work to action, you know, the environment, rewards and losses, things like that. So we put the agents in the same task, well, a similar task that we gave the rats. It was a little different, but basically they could select the left arm, which was high risk, high reward, the right arm, which was low risk, low reward, or they could select stay. And that's the same as the withdrawal. And we ran this for the different agents and we found that the really sad agents, the pessimistic agents, they ended up with a net loss because they gave it a go a few times and they just went back and didn't do the task. They're like, I'm not going to do this anymore. And then we see as optimism increases, they earn more money. But then as optimism gets too much, the agent starts losing money again. So we see in the model, our agent who got the most money was optimism level that we called it was 0.7. So it's not the most optimistic agent. And this is a really important finding because what this shows us is in this task, it's not good just to be the maximum level of optimistic. And this can be because they're not learning enough from the loss or they keep thinking there's something better out there. So they keep changing because in this task, it's best to just stay on the left arm. But the agents who are really optimistic would be like, no, I can get more. So I'm going to go and keep moving around or this kind of behavior. So it doesn't end up with the best outcome. And this is really important because this ties back to all these things we've been saying about the environment of the agent. There's this example that we use in the next version of the paper where it's just think you need to go and fish in a river every day to get fish. And there's a certain level of fish there. And so you need to be optimistic to go and do it every day. But if you're really optimistic and the river is polluted and there's no fish, there's no benefit to be optimistic then. That's not going to be a good thing.
I know we talked about this, like this idea of different environments and then the baseline. But I guess I'm thinking about optimism and how it relates to this idea of resilience. And I don't know if my question is fully formed, but I guess how much is it important, do you think, to have a baseline level of optimism just overall? and how much should we really be varying it depending on the context? Because I'm just thinking that people's life outcomes and experiences are so different. And when people are in super extreme situations, if you're in a place that is war-torn, or if you're just in a situation where things are just not going well for you, if you have an oppressive government, is it good still to be that optimistic? Do you think that 0.7 is really where we should be at in that given environment?
Well, I think these are open questions, but obviously I've thought about them a lot. I guess there's so much that to learn about this. So I also, for the example of someone who's in somewhere that is in a war zone, for example, I had said or was thinking, oh, it wouldn't be adaptive to be optimistic in this situation. And then I spoke to someone who is grew up somewhere where there was a war zone. And they were like, oh, no, Beth, that's not true. We were incredibly optimistic. And I was like, oh, so it's that I would assume, because I don't have any experience of at all how any of that would feel. And I would assume, and I'm just thinking about my simulations and everything. So I'm like, oh, well, there wouldn't be many rewards, so you shouldn't be optimistic. And then I was totally wrong. That wasn't the case at all from this person that I spoke to. So I think when I continue to do this work and test these ideas, like you're saying, I think I'll be surprised. I think it won't just be like anything. There won't be a clear answer for situations like the political situation for countries that we're from. So another thing I like to think about is climate change and optimism around that. And another thing about being optimistic is that if you increase how likely you think something is going to be good, you go and engage in the world. And by engaging in the world, you also change the world. So I don't know what the stats are on climate change are right now, but I know that they're pretty grim. If just say, for example, the likelihood of the world being okay is 10%. If we accept that, we're not going to do anything, because it's like, well, there's no point and there's no chance of it improving. And it's 10%, and that's really grim. So then the world doesn't change. No one engages in environmental action. We don't seek solutions. We don't do those things. If I think, no, there's a 50% chance the world is going to be okay, even though that's not correct, what I do is I go out and I write to politicians, I compost, I help come up with clean energy solutions, I do all these things, which changes that 10% likelihood, because there's always that 10% likelihood of it being okay that we can change. And also 10% isn't zero. If everyone believes it's higher and everyone goes out there and keeps trying, we do increase that chance because we go out and engage in the world and change it. So I guess another thing of thinking about is none of these outcomes in the world are static or fixed, and how we are in the world changes what the world is. So I think that's a very important thing. And I think especially in political situations where it can feel really, if we all, okay, well, there's no hope, so we're not going to riot, we're not going to call, we're not going to do this, we're not going to protest, then okay, then there is no chance.
Yeah, it's like in Twilight.
I don't enjoy it.
When there's one vampire who can tell the future. But sometimes people's actions can change the futures. Then it gets all muddy. Totally get it. But I think that's a very hopeful message, optimistic message to think about. I think this core idea of optimism being about engagement, because I think our lay perception of optimism is that you just think things are going to be okay. But then if it's really about, oh, you're not only thinking that it's maybe going to be okay, but you are going out and approaching the world to be able to do something about it. And I think that question, especially for climate change, I think it falls in with your model. If the real chances that we're going to be okay are 10%, but then someone's optimistic, but they're not completely delusional, they're thinking that it's 50%, then I think that also psychologically pushes you to be like, okay, we're right at the edge. So something could tip it over. Whereas if someone is like, I think 90% we're going to be fine, then that might tip into that inaction point as well.
Exactly. There's got to be these different levels. And also there's going to be different for different people. So maybe for someone thinking the world has a 50% chance of working out, that actually they need it to be higher to do something. Like it's not going to be set for everyone.
Yeah.
It's interesting though, because I know that there's a lot of doomers and pessimists and things like that. Sometimes we have academics come and speak. They're like that. And I also think, well, if I'm going to have a choice about how to live, And I can choose to be pessimistic and think it's all over, there's no hope, there's no nothing. Or I can choose to be optimistic. Like, I'm going to choose, and I know it's not always a choice, but sometimes in these academic settings and the way people are saying how we should research or think about things, like, of course you're going to choose optimism.
I think the question of like, what is a good outcome is also interesting too, because if it's just that you're psychologically okay, then that might lead people to do different things in the sense of, have you seen that movie Don't Look Up?
No.
It's basically just like a very hit you over the head metaphor about climate change. And it's about a meteor heading to the Earth that is going to kill the Earth. And all these scientists are like, the Earth is about to die. And everyone on the morning talk shows are like, oh, okay. And then they're like, well, what are you doing on the weekend? And everyone's just like avoiding that it's happening, because that inevitability is just, people are like, okay, well, I can't deal with that. The outcome for me and my sanity, if I were to try to throw myself into trying to crush this meteor, is too much. And all these scientists are very haggard and don't look happy. So I'm just going to blissfully ignore this. And the outcome overall is that I die. But before I die, I also am like psychologically, at least at a surface level, doing okay. So I feel like that idea of what is a good outcome is also hard to say.
Yeah. And I guess thinking about good outcomes, the other thing with optimism, the way I think about it, is not just self outcomes. So by engaging in the work, because I think all of this positive psychology can end up being very selfish. And what's nice about optimism is, because it's about this engagement, and optimists have stronger social circles, they're like more embedded in the community, that kind of stuff. I think that one of the elements of optimism is the outcomes aren't just you. It's these other things that is shown through optimists having these better social networks and things like that. And I think that comes through that engagement. And animals are social creatures. They need these social systems to survive, and they're optimistic. And so it's something that's about others as well, not just yourself.
But up to a point, right? Because I feel like I know people who are optimistic, but everything has also just gone really well in their lives, and they're not really engaging with certain kinds of things that they might be.
Yeah, that's a really good point. If you're just really lucky and privileged, I actually haven't thought about that. And you're just optimistic because that maybe like they don't even have the asymmetry in belief updating. They're just getting that much good.
Yeah, I think it's true, because when you see people who are super privileged get a negative outcome, they're like, what?
Yeah, so maybe they are. Yeah.
I think the question of what is optimism is really interesting here. And I think it informs the question of what is it exactly that we want to cultivate? Because I think someone hearing about your research might think, oh, do I really just want to cultivate thinking that everything's going to work out, because that might have these issues? But it's really this combination of believing that when I engage in the world, my outcomes will be more positive. And I think that's a more clear path of what we want this to be than just toxic positivity, I guess.
Yeah. And the other thing is, I'm always thinking of it in terms of people with depression. So I guess so when I'm thinking about it being applied, these are people who need it, I guess. When I'm thinking about it, it's like first and foremost for those individuals. But all these other questions are super interesting. And I think understanding it in the holistic sense are really important too.
Okay. We've been talking a while. So maybe we can do, what are you excited about next?
What am I excited about next? Well, I'm finishing my PhD in March, so I'm feeling scared.
No. What do you mean? You should be optimistic. Mixed emotions.
Well, it's my dream to have an optimism lab. I actually already bought the photo for my office. Maybe we can put that on our Instagram.
What do you mean?
I was at this art gallery and they had this photo. It's really beautiful. It's a sunflower growing out of the cement. Oh. That's making me emotional. Oh my God. I bought it. So I was like, if I have an optimism lab one day, I'll put that on in my office.
Aw, that's so sweet. I love that.
So hopefully I'm excited about having an optimism lab. And
Elf optimism lab?
Elf optimism lab.
So good.
And helping people feel like they can engage in their worlds and providing them hope. And it was interesting when we did the wrap paper, it got heaps of media attention. And the most beautiful thing was having people write into us, or there's like Reddit thread and people really relate to people who have suffered from depression or their children have or people that they love have. I'm relating to optimism. I think that's probably been like the biggest highlight of my career so far. So I'm excited about continuing to do this work to help people feel that things can get better and there's a hopeful way forward.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for sharing your research with us. And luckily, I will be very updated on it. And if anyone has thoughts or questions, you can always email us, drop us a line on our podcast. Beth is there. And thank you for being here, Beth.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you to Beth Fisher for joining us this episode.
Our intro and outro music is Nobody Stayed for the DJ by Glacio. Our transition music is Back for More, also by Glacio. Minds Matter is mixed, edited, and created by Beth Fisher, she's the Australian one, and me, Ava Madisouza. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode, but in the meantime, find all our episodes and show notes on mindsmatterpodcast.com.